Yeah, I assume part of this is an issue because students cannot boil their own water. Right, so they need water in a different way that those of us that have kitchens don't. I want to inform those of you who don't already know that Laura Steinbaugh, part of our congregation, is being married this coming weekend, Labor Day weekend. She will be married at 4 in the afternoon, Saturday, September 3rd, that's this coming Saturday, at South Park in Lawrence, Kansas, which is at about the 1100 block of Mass Street. Those who have had a chance to meet her fiancé are genuinely pleased for her, and of course we're all thrilled for him. He's a lucky man. But you are all invited. If you would like to come, I assume there'll be a seat for them. If you'd like to come at 4, the family would love for you as part of the church family to participate in the joy and celebration of her marriage. When is it? What time? Where's it at? Wow, way to go. Okay, so we're at the last part of a sermon series on the second half of Matthew chapter 7, or the last sixth of the Sermon on the Mount. The sermon ends technically at verse 12 of chapter 7, where Jesus says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And then he concludes it with four very strongly worded warnings to his disciples. The first in verses 3 through 14 say, choose the narrow gate that leads down the narrow path to discipleship and don't get stuck on the wide path that leads to destruction. Second warning in verses 15 through 20, he says, look out for false teachers and their false teaching. They will appear as wolves in sheep's clothing. Pay no attention to them. Don't be seduced by them. Judge their tree by their fruit, for it will be burned up, and don't be led down the path to destruction. And then the third one is in verses 21 through 23, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, and that is not everybody who thinks that they're a Christian are actually a Christian. We have to examine our hearts and understand what the test of true faith is, lest we also head down the path to destruction. So we're going to talk about the last of the four, which begins in verse 24 of Matthew chapter 7, but it begins with the word therefore. And if you remember your basic grammar, you know that the word therefore means that what follows from this is based upon what has come before, and you can't properly understand what follows until you understand what has preceded it. So I'm going to read the third warning again, which leads into the fourth warning. Hear then the word of God, Matthew chapter 7, verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundations on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who builds his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. And when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. And thus ends the reading of God's word. I purchased my first house a long time ago with my oldest brother, Mark, at about 71st and Holmes on the Missouri side. You can see a picture of it here, there. It was his decision as to what the house was going to be. He said, I will take care of all the details. All you have to do is put up half the money. And I really didn't want to mess with the details, so that was great. He knew the area he wanted to buy in, the type of house, even the builder he wanted to buy from, and so I let him handle it. So we wanted a English Tudor-style house in the area of town that we purchased it, built by a builder named Fred Deibel, who built all of the houses in that area, and in reasonably good condition. We found the house. It had wood and stucco front with cut rock and brick. It was two full stories with an attic as a partial story and a basement. It had lots of wonderful features. It was very moderately priced, and we were thrilled, but it was not the first house we looked at. In fact, we had to look through a lot of houses to end up with the house that we ended up buying. Now, my brother was a commercial real estate loan officer for a large bank downtown, and he had a client who was a contractor who built only luxury homes. And so my brother and I had learned something from our father growing up that I still practice today, and that is, if I'm not an expert in an area, you ask the expert, well, what is it that I didn't ask you that I should have asked? I don't care what it is. I say the same thing to everybody. I don't know as much as you do, so if you were me, what would you ask that I haven't thought to ask? And then they tell us. Well, so my brother proposes this to this builder, and he says, you know what, even if I told you, you probably wouldn't know how to look for it. So I'll come look at these houses for you. You figure out the ones you want me to look at, and as a favor to you, I will look at the houses. He looked at 10 houses out of the 100 that we had first sort of sorted through before he said, this is the one to buy. And here's how he did it. He would walk in the house. He didn't look at anything other than he would go around and look at the walls and see if there were any cracks in the walls, especially over door frames and around windows. He'd look to see if there was any separation around the windows, and he'd put his hands around to feel if there was any air coming in around the windows. He'd go out to the garage and the driveway, and he would see if it was cracked or if it had shifted any. He would open the door to the basement and just smell, and he said he could tell the difference between just moisture and problems. Then he would go down the basement, and he would see if there were any large stains on the floor. And then he would look at the basement walls to see if there's any cracks or if it was leaning, to see if lateral water pressure had changed, had pushed against the side of the walls. 9 different times he says, you don't want to buy this house, it's going to be a problem. And finally on the 10th one he said, you can buy this one because it is built on a good, stable, solid foundation. And that's the one we purchased. Now, I learned something very important from this that it's pretty obviously the point of Jesus' parable. If you build your life on a good, solid, stable foundation, then you have something rock solid to uphold it. But if you build your life on something that is weak and shifting and unstable, then it's going to cause problems in your life. This is just as true in marriage and parenting and financial planning as it is in building, but it's nowhere more important than it is in regard to our spiritual walks. And if we build our lives on anything other than Jesus Christ, if we allow any values or any priorities that God hasn't given us that aren't consistent with what Jesus has called us to, then it's going to cause a shift in the foundation of our life. It's going to shift our house over from the solid rock to something else, and it's going to present a problem. Now, Jesus did not begin his public ministry until he was in his 30s, most of you know this, which means that at about the age of 9, he began apprenticing as a carpenter with his father. So for over 20 years, Jesus was a carpenter, which meant that he was also a master builder, because they didn't just build tables and chairs, they also built houses. So Jesus took a metaphor from his own profound experience to conclude the greatest sermon ever preached. And he was trying to tell them, look, when you build a house, you've got to, everything else is secondary to what you build it on. By the way, those of you who live in Ottawa know this. It is strange how many houses have shifted in this area. You can go into house after house and see cracked walls and leaning walls and cracked basements and leaning basements, because this is an area that shifts. Now, my house just happens to be built on a rock shelf. So there's absolutely no shifting in my house, but it's very difficult to keep grass growing on the front end of my lawn because the rocks superheat it and fry the roots of the grass. Now, the area in which Jesus lived and operated was very hilly and had very sandy soil. So they understood that if you build a house on sandy soil and the rains come, sort of like LA, the house shifts or the house slides. And even a little gulch or gully can turn into a raging river when the winds blow and the rains start pouring down in that part of the world. And Jesus is saying that wise builders build their house on something that doesn't move, and foolish builders build their house on things that might shift. Now, they were no different than we are back then. They wanted the ideal house in a beautiful green little valley where they could raise crops and raise livestock. But the problem is, in the valley, the ground is the sandiest and the water flows the most, and it's a problem. So people had to build their houses in their little village clusters in places not weren't necessarily the most desirable for farming or cattle, but was the most desirable for locating and trying to keep a house in place. Now, there's multiple similarities in this story that are just as important as the differences between the wise and the foolish builder. Let me give you just three of them. The first is that both builders heard the exact same message. You know, Jesus says, everyone who hears these words of mine, and saying this, he's saying, I have told people the truth. They have heard it directly from me. And everybody who hears it has a choice as to what they're going to do with it. Secondly, both builders began to build their houses after they had heard Jesus' instructions, meaning they both heard Jesus telling them what the truth was, and one of them said, I'm going to build my life on this, I'm going to follow Jesus' instructions, and he proved to be wise, and the other person decided to build his house somewhere else. Now, we don't know what that something else was. Actually, it could be anything else, because anything other than Jesus Christ is shifting sand in this world that John Brockway has said, everything changes but Jesus. We weren't complicit in this, but thank you, John. The most distressing feature of all of this, I think, is that the foolish builder didn't think he was building a house in an unsafe place. I mean, would he have intentionally have gone and built a house in a place that he thought the house was going to be destroyed? No, he's not foolish in the sense that he was stupid. He's foolish in the sense that he put his confidence in that which wasn't worthy of his confidence, versus the wise builder, which put his confidence in something that was worthy of his confidence. And third, both builders built similar houses in the same basic location. We know this because they experienced the same storm. By the way, virtually all houses in the ancient Middle East are exactly the same. They're rectangular houses that have two rooms and that's it. So it didn't matter what the features and amenities. They didn't have instant hot water. They didn't have stainless steel appliances. They had the same basic house. The whole issue was, where did you build your house? Was it a safe place or not? Now, there's two additional things that aren't quite as obvious in the text that I want to point out to you. One is that storms in life are inevitable. Amen? In fact, they're unavoidable. It doesn't matter whether you're a foolish builder or a wise builder, the storms come. It doesn't actually matter whether you have a safe, secure foundation or an unsafe one, the storms come. And Jesus doesn't sugarcoat discipleship here for his disciples. He's basically saying the storms in life are going to assail you. Cyclonic winds are going to come. Torrential rain is going to come down. The water is going to rise. The water is going to flood into your house. And the question is your house going to move or is your house not going to move? Perhaps friends and family have let you down. Perhaps you have a friend who hurt you or someone betrayed you. Perhaps you're stuck in a job that feels like a dead end for you, or it doesn't provide enough money or freedom for you to do the things that you feel like you need to do. Perhaps you've experienced the death of a dream that you had poured your heart and soul into, and the rug was pulled out from underneath you. Perhaps you've struggled with an addiction. Perhaps you've had a marriage fail or crumble around you. Perhaps you've experienced a fatal illness, or someone that you love has experienced a fatal illness and died from it. Perhaps you've had an unplanned financial crisis. The list goes on of the storms that assail people in life, and nobody can protect themselves from everything that can hit them. And life demonstrates to us whether what we are basing our happiness and our joy and our security on proves to be solid rock or whether it proves to be shifting sand. Second thing is that not only do storms, meaning small s and plural, bruise us and buffet us, not only do trials and tribulations come our way, but the storm, capital S singular, awaits all of us. In the Old Testament, they referred to Judgment Day, that day in which we all stand before the hurricane of God's judgment, as the storm. the really big storm. The church today doesn't like to talk about the storm. The church today doesn't like to talk about Judgment Day. Now, unfortunately, several hundred years ago, the church focused on that. The good news is we don't focus on it anymore, but the bad news is that we basically ignore it. Jesus Christ talked twice as much about hell as he did about heaven, and we cannot affirm Jesus' authority and Jesus' integrity if we want to pick and choose the things that he taught that we like versus the things that we don't like. In fact, this is the whole point of these last four warnings. If you choose the wrong path, it will lead to destruction. If you listen to the wrong teaching, it will lead to destruction. If you delude and deceive yourself into thinking that all that really matters is just believing the right things and not doing the right things, it leads to destruction. And here in this parable, that if you build your house on the wrong foundation, it leads to destruction. By the way, there are three categories of believers that are going to stand before God on the judgment day. First, there are demons and fallen angels and rebellious human beings who knew the truth but didn't want to respond to it and said, I'll just shoot craps and take my chance and see what happens in the next life. James says, you say you believe in God, so what? Even demons believe in God, and as a result, they fear and tremble. It's not enough to just believe the right things. Secondly, there will be many genuine believers who have exercised their faith, and it has proven to be saving faith, and they know this because they've seen their life and their values and their lifestyle slowly but surely transformed over the years. And on the day of judgment, they will hear God say, well done, my good and faithful servant. Be welcome into your Father's good pleasure. But third, there will be many good people, and this is Jesus' point. He says, many. Many good people, even churchgoers who believe the right things, perhaps feel the right things, have done some of the right things, but who don't have saving faith, and they've been living their life in the self-delusion that just believing the right things gets the job done, and not believing the right things that leads to doing the things that God demands of us as his saved children. So this is why Jesus says in Matthew chapter 7, verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. It isn't enough just to know who he is and to believe what he has said. We have to do something with what we say we believe. Jesus says that there is one infallible test to salvation, and that is obedience. We talked about this 2 weeks ago, this paradox between the fact that we are saved by grace through faith, not as a result of anything we do, but once we're saved, we know we're saved because our life begins to be transformed. We think differently, we value differently, we live differently. Here's the way I like to think of it, is that no one is saved because he is obedient, but no one who is saved is not obedient. If we're saved, were obedient. Osmandius is a fairly well-known figure in ancient history. He's actually the Greek name for Ramses II, the Egyptian pharaoh. Percy Shelley wrote a famous poem about him, which is how we know about him historically. But apparently, during his reign in Egypt, he built this gigantic statue of him on the western edge of his empire that said, as on the base of the statue, it said, look upon all my mighty works, you who consider yourselves to be mighty, and despair. So this was intended as an invader comes in from the west and sees this giant statue and knows all of the wonders of the Egyptian kingdom that they should quake and fear because of his mighty works. Apparently 100 years later, the statue had fallen over and was lying face down in the sand, sand desert as far as the eye could see, but the pedestal was still there, and it still said, look upon all my mighty works, you who consider yourselves to be mighty and despair. And now rather than discouraging invaders, it spoke to every poor nomad out on the desert saying, hey, you put your hope in anything that human beings come up with or that is false and faulty, and it will crumble underneath you. The question Jesus raises for his disciples as he closes the Sermon on the Mount, everything he has wanted to say to them about what a Christian looks like, about what discipleship involves, about the things we should be doing and shouldn't be doing, he ends with this statement, Are you going to build your life on the solid rock? And will the foundation upon which you've built your life stand? Now, here's the challenge for us. Anybody in this room who believes that they're a Christian would say, well, of course I've built my life on the rock of Jesus Christ. But there's a difference between what you say you believe in and what you're actually doing. When you plan your finances, when you engage in your relationships, when you are dating a guy and a girl, when you approach your career, when you manage your values and your priorities, is it the rock that all of those decisions and values are based upon? Or are you just saying, well, the rock is where I'm putting my confidence and my salvation, but all this other shifting sand over here is what I'm basing my decisions and values and lifestyle and other things on? And the painful reality is that's true to one degree or another for all of us. We pick and choose the things that we want to build on the rock and other things we like out in the shifting sand where things are a little easier to maneuver and manipulate. A.W. Tozer, the great preacher in the 1950s and 60s, said, wouldn't it be great if God put a regulator on us that kept us from talking about anything that we weren't currently putting into practice? It would certainly keep me from ever preaching. But the painful reality is, we believe all kinds of things we do nothing about. I want to share with you a story that I think I've shared with you before. Maybe you've heard it somewhere else. I need to read a good portion of this. And preaching theory says you should never read anything that's really long. Too bad. It's a great story. William Borden was the sole heir of the vast Borden fortune. This was Borden milk, Borden glue, vast silver mines in the West. He was a multimillionaire the day he was born. He graduated from high school at the age of 16 in 1904, and as a graduation present, his parents sent him on a trip around the world, and as he passed through Asia and through the Middle East, he was convicted of the plight of lost and suffering souls, and so he wrote a letter back home to his father, who had protested that Borden had become a Christian 2 years before. He said, "This is foolishness." He wrote a letter home and said he was feeling a call to one day become a missionary. So upon his return, he was told by virtually everybody, including his father, that he was throwing his life away if he would become a missionary. And in response, Borden took out his Bible that he had not been reading too much at that point, and in the back, he wrote two words, "no reserve," and he wrote the date. Now, his first day of class at his freshman year at Yale, he took out his Bible and he wrote this sentence down, "Say no to self and yes to Jesus every single time." And he jumped on the first conviction that God laid on his heart, and that is that he should offer to pray every morning with his roommate in the dorm before they began the day. And so they did it. Before long, half of their dormitory floor was praying with him. And by the end of the year, the entire dormitory floor was praying with him. In fact, over 150 students met with him every morning to study the Bible and to pray together. And by the end of his senior year, 1,000 of Yale's 1,300 students at the time were meeting every single morning with Borden to pray and to study the Word together. And among the numerous things he accomplished during his 4 years at Yale was that he founded an outreach ministry to widows and orphans and cripples in the community of New Haven, Connecticut, that still operates today as the Yale Hope Mission. He was captain of the tennis team, captain of the golf team, which was a big deal back then. He was president of the Phi Beta Kappa chapter. He was valedictorian of the school. His family could not have been more proud of him until, in addition to turning down numerous high-paying job offers his senior year, he informed them that he was once again committed to becoming a missionary after he had received the appropriate training. Virtually everybody, including his family and his mother, who was a believer, attempted to talk him out of this. So just before his departure to go overseas after his training, his father wrote him this note. "Why have you chosen to throw your life away in some foreign country where only poverty and sacrifice await you? Stay in New England where you could have a life of influence from a position of prominence. Good God, man, you're a Borden. You don't belong in China. You belong in Boston. Now, I know you mean well, but why would you choose to build your future on such a shaky foundation when a rock-solid one has been provided for you here?" Isn't that interesting? Be obedient to God. Go where he calls you, and that's a shaky foundation, but stay home where you've got money and influence and security, and that will be a rock-solid foundation. Stop this nonsense and come home. That day, he wrote two more words in the back of his Bible along with the date, and they were, "No retreat." Now, Borden knew that the only rock-solid foundation in life was Jesus Christ. His father was clearly confusing education and income and power and position and worldly success with a rock-solid foundation. So while he was in Egypt, sadly still on his way to China, before he'd had a chance to accomplish any of the goals that he had set for himself, he contracted cerebral meningitis. Or is that cerebral? Cerebral. Close enough. It became quickly evident to everyone, including himself, that he would soon die. And so he wrote this letter that he mailed to his father. "It's entirely possible that when you learn of my death in a foreign country before I have even reached my final destination, that you will say to yourself, 'What a waste. What a fool. I told him so if he had only just listened.' Father, I did listen, but I listened to my heavenly Father, who gave me very similar advice to the advice you gave me. But instead of telling me to build my life on the shaky foundation of worldly values and success, he told me to build it on the unshakable foundation of his love and his forgiveness and his clear calling in my life, and that's what I have done. It is my prayer that one day God will break through to you and help you to understand this truth. My life is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand." Does this sound familiar? 75 years early, Edward Mote had written the words to the hymn that we're going to sing in closing today, "Christ, the Solid Rock." My life was built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. Now, apparently the day before he died, he wrote two more words in his Bible. "No regret," he wrote. Borden's father did not receive the Bible back from Egypt for several months after the funeral. He was angry and fuming that his son had wasted his life. And when he read these words in the Bible, things changed. In fact, after reading all of the notes that his son had written throughout his Bible, he committed his life to Christ. And at his own funeral, a man who had rejected Christ most of his life, he asked that these words be read aloud. "No reserve, no retreat, no regret. Let no other voice in life distract you from God's calling. And build your future on no other foundation than Jesus Christ. When God calls, answer immediately. It is not he who merely hears, but he who puts into practice God's words that will be saved. I lived my final years in gratitude for a son who lost his life so that I might gain my own." By the way, isn't that the message of the Christian life? That we live our entire lives in gratitude for Christ who gave his life that we might have our own. You know, it's so easy to listen to missionary stories or stories of famous people and go, "Yeah, that's really interesting. That doesn't really apply to me." You know, that's the difference between people like that and me. The difference between people like that and you is that they make those kind of decisions under those kind of circumstances and it changes the way their life go. And then we're left to go, "Well, I wish I thought different thoughts, done different things, and engaged in different activities." And it's a mantra that goes on and on year after year. Versus those people who say, "Every time Jesus calls, I will say yes and never no." And that's part of what it means to build our life on the solid rock of Jesus Christ. Not just to say, "Love me, forgive me, save me," but "Guide me and direct me, and I will be your man and your woman." So that our lives will be lived with no reserves and no retreats and no regrets. Will you please join me in prayer? Father, there's so many things in life that we say yes to, and sadly, all too often we say no to you. We are so glad that Jesus died for us and provides the rock-solid foundation for our faith. But Father, it's a faith that needs to be lived out by doing the will of our Father that is in heaven. May our lives be filled with the joy that comes from knowing that we're loved, but also comes from knowing that we are following where you lead. Father, help us to recognize where the shifting sand is in our life and to shift ourselves over to Jesus Christ. We ask these things in his name and for his sake. Amen. Christ the solid rock. If you want to use one of our beautiful new hymnals, you are welcome to do so. We will be singing verses 1, 2, and 4 of number 526, but they'll also be on the screen, right? Right. Would you please stand and join in singing?